Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sacrifice sure footing for a killing stroke.
What's conducting the electricity?
Our bodies, Mr. Angier, are quite capable of conducting and indeed producing energy.
I apologize. There simply is too much magic.
The good cop, bad cop routine?
Not exactly.
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. In this podcast, the great Jack Howard and I got together with the aim of putting all the Christopher Nolan films in our order of preference. There are currently 10 Christopher Nolan films, not counting Tenet, which none of us have seen yet. So we decided to, okay, let's do a top 10 in which Jack does his top 10 Christopher Nolan movies and I do my top 10 and we see how they match up. Now, we recorded this conversation a few days ago and we've just discovered today that the release of Tenet has been put back yet again. So currently no one actually knows when Tenet is going to open. However, as it stands, the top 10 discussion that we had didn't include Tenet anyway because none of us have seen it. So sit back and enjoy our top 10 rundown. Here's a word of warning. We thought we were going to get all of this into one podcast. We failed horribly. So the way I suggest that we do this is we go through the list, starting at number 10, and I call out my number 10, and you call out your number 10, but we don't talk about the movie until we've both cited it in the chart. I just think that's going to make some kind of sense of what is, let's
yeah,
face
I
it.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I also think that it's going to be so interesting. I think we're going to go out of sync with each other quite a lot on this. Yeah, I don't imagine we're going to have similar feelings on these movies.
Which is weird because when we did Star Wars, we were much more in sync with each other than we had imagined. So
But I think because Star Wars is a thing I came to quite late, whereas I think Christopher Nolan is the director that I discovered in my formative years as a film fan as a filmmaker. So okay. I think he's had such a great influence on me. And so for the last couple of weeks, because I knew we were doing this, I've gone back and revisited almost every single Christopher Nolan film. And I also watched Following for the first time because I'd never seen it before. Okay. So I have amount of things to say about all of these films.
Okay. Well, in that case, it's a long podcast. I hope you're listening to this either on a long run or a long car journey. Yeah, exactly. So strap in. So let's start with at number 10 for me, the film you just mentioned, Following, which is of course the very first Christopher Nolan feature. What's your number 10?
My number 10 is The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay, fine. So in that case, we're going to move on until we hit one together. So for number 9, for me, Insomnia.
Number 9 for me is Interstellar.
Wow. Oh, wow. Okay, Jack, this is...
Save it, save it.
Yeah, okay. No, it's just interesting. Okay, so number 8 for me, Interstellar.
Number 8 for me is Following.
Okay, so we've both got Interstellar and Following in the lower three. Okay,
right. Yes.
So we can do Interstellar now because I've said Interstellar. So you've got it at number 9, and I've got it at number 8. You go first.
I think that Interstellar is Christopher Nolan's most frustrating film. I think it's a Frankenstein mess. I remember the first time I ever watched it, I was so hyped up and excited about it. I went to the premiere, luckily enough. So hyped up and just immediately was like, oh no, like from like the opening few moments, because I think that we all know that Nolan, there's almost like a meme at this point that Nolan is overly expositional. Like he likes dialogue. He likes things being explained, but we'll come to sort of talk about how he does that really well in movies like Inception later on.
Okay.
But I think that this is overly expositional from the off. Like I think a lot of people talk about how the last moments. I mean, also, by the way, everybody, fully spoilers for every single movie we're talking about here.
Well pointed out. I should have
your
said
own
that.
Fault.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you haven't seen these movies, but full spoilers.
So, that's right.
What I was going to say there was that everyone complains about...
She's a guy, it's a sledge. Yeah, just get used to it. Okay, fine.
Everyone complains about the overly expositional stuff when Matthew McConaughey's in the Tesseract at the end, about him being like, don't you get it, Tars? It's us. We're doing this in the future. We're doing this. And it's just him explaining it all in sort of like 2001, but for idiots, like, yeah. Which obviously is frustrating. But it's from the start of the movie that it's overly expositional, eye-rollingly expositional. At the moment that he's having a meeting with his daughter's teachers, and they're talking about how the moon landings were faked and things like that, and then he essentially just goes, well, that makes me think of my dead wife. And it's just like, why are you talking about your dead wife now? Because you just know we need to know it. And then it's also, I think, the movie that I find the hardest to invest in out of Nolan's movies. And he deals with some huge concepts, but the dust is coordinates, let's go. I don't believe you at all. And then when he goes there, he gets to NASA and there's a rocket behind a wall. Like, what? I don't understand, like, this storytelling. That it seems stupid to me. And the reason why I call it Frankenstein as well is because something, maybe not everybody knows this, but the premise of Interstellar was conceived by Linda Obst, I think her name is, and a theoretical physicist called Kip Thorne, and they were put together. They collaborated on Contact, and they were put together to come up with something, and they did like an 80-page document. And then Jonathan Nolan was hired in 2007, I believe, to write the screenplay for Steven Spielberg to direct. And I think a lot of the elements in this movie, the father-daughter stuff specifically, or that emotional ties to the movie, I think is leftover stuff from the Jonathan Nolan draft for Steven Spielberg. And I think a lot of that stuff would have worked a lot better in the hands of Steven Spielberg. And then all the scientific theoretical, like, wormhole stuff, all that grand stuff is incredible to watch. Like, in the good category, the Miller's Planet, the water planet, is incredible. Like, it's classic Nolan stuff, the rising tension, and those aren't mountains, those are waves. Incredible.
That is a great moment.
It's incredible. That's pure cinema. And then coming back 23 years later and seeing his children grow up on screen in a matter of minutes over 23 years is extremely emotional. And it's the scenes like that, and later we'll talk about Dunkirk as well, when I reject the idea that people say that Nolan can't do emotion. And Michael Caine's death is incredible. I think it might be Hans Zimmer's best score ever. Like, it's so beautiful and so, like, ethereal, and it's amazing.
We're talking now about the score for Interstellar?
Completely, yeah.
Yes, fine. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. I think that the docking sequence as well, incredible. Like, there's good stuff in it, and this is why I find it frustrating, because I think that it's like everything that Anne Hathaway says is dumb. Hiding Matt Damon, calling him Dr. Man, is dumb. Like, explaining the wormhole when they're in space is dumb. I think it's just a lot of dumb stuff dressed up to look clever, and I don't really care if it's based on anything like real, because the way that it's been expressed to me feels stupid. And then, just to top it all off, the cherry on the top is that the emotional through line of this story from the very start, the first half an hour is absolutely based on this, is father-daughter. That is what it's asking us to care about. It's between father and daughter. And the movie betrays itself at the end. They are reunited at the end when she's an old woman and he's the same age, and it's emotional, and she says, I knew my dad would come back, and then he leaves again. And I'm just watching it being like, Nolan, this is wrong, and I hope that you know now that you've made a mistake, because that was your emotional tie, and you cut to black there and you've got a better film. Yeah. Already a better film.
You told him I like Barman. Me, Murph. How is your ghost?
I know. People didn't believe me. They thought that I was doing it all myself. But I knew who it was. No. nobody believed me. But I knew he'd come back.
Okay, so I think they should have cut to black a long time before that. I think they should have cut to black at the point when he goes into the other dimension. I think everything about coming out and, you know, oh, they're all right, it's fine. And then he's back home and then it's Ellen Burstyn. I think all of that stuff is nonsense. The stuff I love about the film, I've seen it 3 times now and I've seen it on IMAX. I think it is experiential in the same way that it must have been watching, you know, the early Méliès stuff or, you know, watching... I remember Christopher Nolan talking about his love of cinema, and then you watch Interstellar and you go, that's a movie made by somebody who loves cinema. I agree with you about the Frankenstein nature of the script, although I love Contact, you see, and there is a lot
Contact's
of Contact.
A much better film.
It is a better film. Well, it's a better script, but there's a lot of Contact, and there's a moment in Contact when Jodie Foster's character says they should have sent a poet. And I went back and I looked at my review of Interstellar when it came out. And I said, in many ways, with Nolan, that is what they did. They sent a visual poet. But I agree with you that the script and the exposition in the script and he's behind the bookcase, but then all that stuff is like, stop talking.
From the beginning, just the opening moments when she says, there's a ghost in my room. I was like, that's Matthew McConaughey. I know this movie's going to deal with time travel. It's Matthew McConaughey. And like, just from the start, itself away.
But there are individual things in it. I mean, like the moment when it cuts from the drive to the, you know, to the takeoff, all that sort of stuff. There are moments in it that are so breathtaking that actually, you know, Stanley Kubrick said that at the end of 2001, you didn't need to understand what was going on. You just needed to experience it. I like Interstellar because of the experience of it. I think the exposition is unnecessary. And actually, if they made it with nobody saying anything, with nobody ever explaining what's going on, I think it would have been fun. But I also felt that it was kind of part of Chris Nolan's popcorn thing, which was, I would like the audience to understand this. But okay, just because I think we've got a lot to get through. It's interesting that we both have it, although we both think that, you know, it has an extraordinary score and it looks amazing. It's not even in the top 5. It's in the top 3.
Yeah.
Now, the other one that you chose at number 3 and I chose at number 10, you put it at number 7, was Following. And the reason I put Following at number 10 was because, not that it's a bad film, and incidentally, I don't think any of these films are bad films.
I think that's probably a good thing to sort of point out now, even when I'm ranting about Interstellar, is that literally no Christopher Nolan film
is a bad
is without
film.
Merit.
Yeah.
Like, so they all have something worthwhile in them. I completely agree that Interstellar has moments that I just enjoy the experience of.
I think it's more than moments. I think there are. I mean, I've been reduced to tears by Interstellar. I still think there are things wrong with it, but I still think it's breathtaking.
Yeah, no, I was when I rewatched it, I cried at that moment when he comes back and watches his daughter grow up.
Following, I had at number 10, not because it's a bad film, but because it's the beginning of everything. It's before he really kind of finds his feet. I mean, in a way, it's what's fascinating about it is because you can see what's then going to come. You can see the non-linear thing. You can see the deceptively labyrinthine double crosses. You can see the sense of characters not being what they appear to be. It also tells you that one of the key things about understanding Nolan's work is that he's obsessed with that that film noir thing about deception. And you look at something from two different angles and it looks like a different thing. And that is a very noir-y kind of concoction. And in the case of Following, it's at number 10 for me because that's a compliment, incidentally, because it's like, okay, you got better. You know, you started here and there was no point that you went there. And let's face it, we all know plenty of filmmakers, you know, who started there and then went down there. So it's at number 10 for me just because it's the beginning. It's him finding his feet. It's 16mm. It's shot under very stressful circumstances. You know, it's the beginning.
It was shot over the course of a year, I believe. That's on weekends.
On weekends,
which is incredible. But you're right, actually. You look at Following and then you look at the guy who's now making Tenet and you go, oh, that's the same person. And then you look at Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and you look at Aladdin and you go, who's that guy? Who are you? I agree with you. I think what I wrote down for it was that it was like all rough around the edges. It was the beginning of all Nolan's tricks, the smart nonlinear storytelling. I love that it was using its limitations as a positive rather than going, we can't do this thing. Like I've seen him talk about it and say, oh, we made it a hammer instead of a gun, because in low budget movies, when you have a prop gun, you can never make it look right. So we made it a hammer and that's more effective. And I think that going forward is what Nolan's doing over and over again, is going, okay, what's the most effective piece of storytelling? He's not always thinking about what's true to it? What's right for it? Like, he's thinking, what can I do effectively to give people the best experience? Yeah. And I put it at number seven.
But you put it above Interstellar.
Oh no, mine's number eight. Sorry, it's number eight.
Oh, fine, okay. Yeah, number eight, but you had Interstellar at number nine, right?
Yes, because I find
you think
both The Dark Knight Rises
than Interstellar.
Look, it's not. I enjoyed watching Following more than I enjoyed rewatching Interstellar. I think that he's a better filmmaker when he made Interstellar, but okay. I think that Following is a better film. I think that Following is like a coherent. You know, it's got a better script. It shows him being a better storyteller. And I think Interstellar, has better moments and bigger flair and better actors and all that sort of stuff and bigger ideas that are explored in a really, really incredible way. But I think that Following, for what it is, like they're incomparable to each other. But I think Following.
We're doing a list. Everything is comparable. Yeah. That's how it works.
Shut up, Mark.
I'd just like to say, just for the record, just in case anyone's missed this. Jack thinks that Following is a better film than Interstellar. The Dark Knight Rises, I think you'll get less pushback on, but as far as Interstellar is concerned, it's okay.
You heard me rant. I think Interstellar is, the whole thing for Interstellar can be summed up by Topher Grace when he's in the film saying, "We don't have time for this." one more thing on Interstellar, because I just want to get this out there, is that Nolan is really famous for his cross-cutting action and his sort of intertwined sequences, and they have images in them that have no relation to each other, but they feel like they're connected in some way. And Interstellar to me just feels incoherent when it's doing that moment when she's figuring out the bookcase and he's in space and it's being intercut with the crops being burnt down. I'm like, this is madness. This feels like you're trying to make sense of it in the edit. It doesn't feel like you knew what this was, whereas every other cross-cutting sequence that Nolan's ever done does feel like it relates to each other and builds to a crescendo. And that just felt like, I guess we'll just slap some stuff together. It doesn't feel like it has a firm grasp on itself.
Get to the hat! Go, go, go!
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, because we have to finish this podcast today, Jack, I'm going to move us on to number seven.
All right, so stop patronizing me.
I'm not patronizing. I'm just looking at the clock and thinking, you know, I've had a birthday since you started talking about Interstellar. At number seven for me, Dunkirk. And again, I'll say this, you know, it's...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. So shall I go first?
Well, hang on. I haven't done Dunkirk.
No, what's your number seven? Dunkirk. Sorry.
My number seven is Insomnia.
Okay, fine. So my number...
I think we've both done Insomnia now.
Following... Yes, I had Insomnia at number nine. Okay, so let's do Insomnia first, then we'll move on to Dunkirk. Okay, so Insomnia, go.
Insomnia, it's... I don't know. I think maybe on this, on different days, this might be in a different order. Insomnia, the biggest problem with Insomnia is it's not Seven. That's the biggest problem with Insomnia. so clearly wants
Dear
to be Seven.
Christopher Nolan, I very much enjoyed your film Insomnia. However, it was not Seven. Yours, Jack.
I think that it's it's a start of the stuff that Nolan becomes very, very interested in, which is the sort of duality stuff, the two sides of the same coin, the detective who understands the terrible criminal. It's got a lot of like very blunt imagery in it that I always really like in movies. I'm quite a sucker for that stuff. So the blaring sun coming through the window, like representation, which is a representation of his guilt that he can't keep out, and he can't sleep, that it's literally foggy when he shoots his partner and he is quite foggy literally about that. I like stuff like that. Yeah. And I like that it's structured a bit like Wicker Man. Like, it's a guy who arrives to a strange place and it's weird and messes with his mind. And I find Insomnia an interesting watch, an entertaining watch. I think actually it might be one of my favorite Al Pacino performances as well. And Robin Williams is just so creepy in it. And you can see why he was being considered for the Joker when Nolan was originally doing that. I find it very, very good. I think it was actually kind of Nolan's audition to do Batman. I think they liked him from Memento and they were like, okay, let's see how you, this is all speculative, but it feels like they're going, okay, let's see how you do with two of the biggest stars in the world and this amount of money, especially because it's the only film that Nolan has made that he's not a writer on. It feels like it's like, all right, let's see how you do with that. So it feels quite by the numbers in certain ways, but it feels like he's exploring some of the flair that we get to see later in some bigger movies, thematically and with his actual film filmmaking itself. Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's just very good.
I have great respect for your profession, but the situation isn't yours to control, Will.
You're trying to impress me, Finch. You had the wrong guy.
It took you 10 minutes to beat Kate Connell to death.
No evidence that I killed Kay. You only know it because I told you.
Are you doing okay? I mean, you haven't been sleeping much, Detective Dormer.
Another night up like this and you're really going to lose it.
Now the game has turned deadlier than he ever imagined.
This whole thing you're doing ain't going to work with me.
Hold it!
Where is she, Finch?
Don't worry, Will. You can sleep when you're dead.
In response to what you just said about Insomnia, I think that the reason it's quite far down the list for me, I mean, I think it looks absolutely brilliant. Early example of that, you know, Scandi Noir, the idea of a thriller taking place in bright daylight, in which the whole point is that you can't block out the light, is really interesting, particularly when you think about Nolan's interest in noir and in what we then think of with the Dark Knight trilogy, in which it's all darkness, it's all shadows. That's all to do with Wally Pfister and the way in which Wally Pfister can make darkness visible. And I do think the performances are great. I think Pacino is great. I think Hilary Swank is great. I think Robin Williams is extraordinary. My only issue would be it is very close to the Erik Skjoldbjerg original. And in a way, it's kind of like an awful lot of the stuff that you've just said is great about it is also great about the original film. In fact, I found this was a quote from the director of the original. He said he was asked what he thought of the Nolan some years after. He said, well, I haven't seen it for quite a while, but when I first saw it, it was a very strange experience because it is quite close stylistically to the original. He then goes on to say, I felt lucky that it's such a well-crafted, smart film. It had a really good director handling it because as a remake, I think it did really well. It doesn't hurt any original if a remake is done. So I felt I was lucky that Christopher Nolan did it, which is, you know, a very charitable thing to say. But it is true that I saw the remake first and then I saw the original, and I was surprised by how close they are to each other. I mean, there are fundamental differences, both in terms of narrative and in terms of the way in which it kind of shifts the guilty underpinning of the story. But it is. I mean, you know, there are remakes that I love. We've spoken about, you know, Soderbergh's Solaris and Friedkin's Wage of Fear, but it's just down the line for me because it is a remakey remake, as opposed to a kind of, you know, a statement of original intent. That's my only issue with it, and that's not to say it's not a good remake. But you kind of feel like if you're going to praise it, you have to praise the original as well. And too few people have seen the original, which is a shame. So you should seek the. Have you seen the original film?
No, I haven't. Yeah, that's my bad.
No. Of course, I mean nobody has. But check it out. In fact, funnily enough, when they released the original on DVD, on video, pardon me, because it was that long ago, they released it with a cover that looked exactly like the poster of Insomnia, you know, with the two faces and the black and the white, because they were trying to say, hey, you remember this film? You really, it's like when they put out LA Takedown, the Michael Mann film upon which he based Heat, and they made the cover of the video look exactly like Heat, as if to say, look, you liked Heat, this is the one before. But I still think it's a really good film. I think it is a really, really well, you know, well made film. I just, you know, it's,
yeah, I think the best thing, I think the worst thing I can say about Insomnia, because I haven't seen the original, is that Insomnia to me feels quite functional, and I think that makes sense because it was Nolan's first foray into this into this type of filmmaking with huge stars and you know it's the first time he shot a plane and that just continued from there.
This is a plane.
I think I'll film one of these in every film from now on. Thank you very much.
Okay, so moving on to my number seven, as I said before, is Dunkirk, which you had a little intake of breath about, which I think means that it's higher up in your chart. So
yes, it
is. That was my number seven, and your number seven was Insomnia. So my number six, The Dark Knight.
Oh my God. I need to have a moment with that for a second. I can't. Okay. What? Oh, we're going to have a big fight. Okay. My number six is Batman Begins.
Oh my God.
No. I'm not standing for this.
I'm sorry. It's, you know, if we were in the same place, we would have a stand up rabbit. But. Have you seen, there's a brilliant film out, well, it's not out at the moment because they delayed the release. There's a brilliant film called St. Francis, in which there's a fantastic confrontation between two people in the park. And this mother of this child says, because one of them is a sort of, you know, right-wing Trumpy person who's complaining about her breastfeeding in the park. And the mother says to her, I think we have a responsibility to show our children that even though we disagree, we can do it civilly.
Okay, and you think that's what we are to our audience?
In the spirit of which, so we can't do Dunkirk yet, and we can't do Dark Knight yet,
so and we can't do Batman Begins yet.
No, so that takes us on to number five. Okay,
top five. Here we go.
Top five. Number five for me, Dark Knight Rises.
You are insane. You are insane.
And number five for you.
Number five for me is Memento.
Oh, okay. You're not insane, but you're okay. So that's interesting. So here's what we're going to do, Jack. This has now taken us to the half an hour point, and we're just going to run down in order our number 10 to number six, and then we're going to pick up in a second podcast at number five and finish this gentlemanly discussion. So. At number 10, my number 10 is Nolan's first film, Following.
For me, it's The Dark Knight Rises.
At number 9, Insomnia, largely because I think that the remake is a lot of what's, the original is a lot of what's great about the remake.
For me, number 9 is Interstellar, because I think it's Nolan's most frustrating Frankenstein film that he's ever made.
At number 8, I'm kind of agreeing with you, Interstellar. I think I like it slightly more, but I do agree with all the stuff about the exposition.
Number 8 for me is Following, because it's Nolan's first film and you can see all the tricks that he starts to play with. And I also think it's a really slick and smart thriller.
Okay, so we're kind of on the same page. Then number 7 for me, Dunkirk.
Number 7 for me is Insomnia. Functional, but good.
Okay. Number six for me is The Dark Knight.
I want to be sick every time you say that. Number six for me is Batman Begins.
Okay, and then we're going to pick up our next podcast with number five. And I've already told you that at number five for me, it's Dark Knight Rises. And for you, it's Memento. Thanks so much for listening to this Kermit on Film podcast. If you want to see this, if you want to visualize, I mean, honestly, you need to see Jack explaining the plot of Interstellar. You know, I thought I had wavy hands, but that was particularly magnificent. Join us for the next Kermit on Film podcast, where we're going to pick this up from number five to number one. And I have the feeling it's going to get bloody. Thanks ever so much. If you've enjoyed listening, tell your friends, please visit our Patreon page. As I said, look at the video stuff. Incidentally, thanks to everybody for being a Kermit on Film listener. We just passed the 3 million listens mark, which
that's cool.
Yeah. And I should say, Jack, an awful lot of that is to do with you. So thank you very much to everybody for pushing us past the 3 million mark. Nobody is more delighted or surprised than I am.
Thank you so much. I genuinely love doing this podcast. It's a joy for me. And I'm glad that people enjoy listening to us rant at each other.
Yeah. Well, 5-1 is coming on the next Kermit on Film podcast. Thanks so much.
Honestly, I'm getting the knuckle dusters on.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.